Leonardo at the Belvedere was a German assistant who was supposed to be helping him construct his mirrors and produce some for the wardrobe rooms of the Pope and Giuliano. But he was disloyal, lazy, and erratic, causing Leonardo to go into a tailspin of rage. He became physically ill as well as petulant, and his psychological unhinging was splayed out in three long drafts of complaining letters intended for Giuliano. This was not the first time that Leonardo's bouts of torment seemed to spiral out of control. Back when he was in Milan, he had walked off the job of decorating rooms for the Duke, drafted a fiery letter of complaint, and then torn it in half. But the letters he drafted for Giuliano were of a different order of megatonnage. He told the stories of his clashes with the German in lengthy and disjointed diatribes that verged on the paranoid and were cluttered with details and digressions that would likely have baffled Giuliano. He wrote of the wickedness of that German deceiver and of how the boy betrayed him by building his own workshop so he could do jobs for other people. Leonardo also denounced him for wasting his days bird hunting with the Swiss guards. This is not the sweet Leonardo we usually see, tending to young acolytes and twinkling fondly at the transgressions of the rascally Salai. Leonardo's other nemesis was another German staying at the Belvedere, a rival mirror maker named Giovanni. Leonardo wrote in a draft letter, "That German, Giovanni the mirror maker, was in the workshop every day wanting to see everything that I was doing and then broadcasting it around and criticizing whatever he could not understand." He accused Giovanni of being jealous, then rambled on semi-coherently about how Giovanni had turned the young assistant against him. During this time, Leonardo continued his anatomical studies, dissecting at least three corpses in Rome, probably at the Hospital of the Holy Spirit, Santo Spirito, and refining his drawings of the human heart. Dissections were not illegal, but Leonardo was stopped from continuing with them. "The Pope has found out that I have skinned three corpses," he wrote, "and he blamed it on the jealous Giovanni. This person has hindered me in anatomy, denouncing it before the Pope and also at the hospital." Leonardo's foul mood and his lack of artistic productivity, in stark contrast to Michelangelo and Raphael at the time, served to alienate him from the Medici orbit. The situation worsened when Giuliano's influence declined. He was sent off in early 1515 to marry the daughter of a French duke and then died a year later after a long bout with tuberculosis. It was time for Leonardo to move on once again. He found a new opportunity when he was invited to be part of Pope Leo's entourage to Florence and Bologna. The Medici Pope triumphantly entered his native Florence in November 1515. One observer reported, "All the chief citizens went in procession to meet him, and among others about 50 youths, only the richest and foremost, dressed in a livery of clothing of purple cloth with fur collars, going on foot, and each with a type of small silvered lance in his hands, a most beautiful thing." Leonardo drew in his notebook the temporary arch that had been built for the procession. When the Pope arrived at the council hall for a gathering of cardinals, the remnants of Leonardo's unfinished Battle of Anghiari were still visible on the wall. In Florence, the Pope also convened a gaggle of top artists and architects to discuss renewing Florence the way Bramante was Rome. Leonardo made drawings of his ideas for completely reworking and expanding the plaza in the Medici quarters and demolishing the houses in front of the Church of San Lorenzo, which would have destroyed many of the streets and alleys of his younger days, and drew the Medici Palace with a new facade that faced the new Grand Plaza. But Leonardo did not stay in Florence. Instead, he followed the papal procession to Bologna, where the Pope had scheduled a secret parley with the new King of France, Francis I, who had just turned 21. Francis had wrested control of Milan from the Sforzas in September 1515, which convinced the Pope he had to make peace with him. The parley did not settle the French-Italian wars, but it would eventually result in finding Leonardo a new patron. He was at the meetings between the Pope and the King, and at one session he made a black pencil sketch of Artus Gouffier, the King's tutor and chambermaster. It is likely that in Bologna, the King first tried to entice Leonardo to come to France. Chapter 30. Pointing the Way. the Word becomes flesh. During the decade of 1506 to 16, as he wandered between Milan and Rome, pursuing his passions and seeking patronage, Leonardo worked on three paintings that have an elegiac and spiritual quality, as if he realized that his days were numbered and was contemplating what lay on the road ahead. These include two sensuous paintings of St. John the Baptist, one of them converted into a rendering of Bacchus by someone many years later, and a painting of an angel of the Annunciation that has been lost. They feature, as do their related drawings, a sweetly androgynous young man with an enigmatic aura, looking, or perhaps even leering, directly at the viewer and pointing a finger. Despite his immersion into science, or perhaps because of it, Leonardo had developed an ever-deepening appreciation for the profound, spiritual mystery of our place in the cosmos. And, as Kenneth Clark noted, mystery to Leonardo was a shadow, a smile, and a finger pointing into darkness. What distinguishes these paintings is not that they have a religious theme, like the work of every other Renaissance master, most of Leonardo's paintings did. Nor are they the only times that Leonardo used a pointing gesture. St. Anne in the Burlington House cartoon and St. Thomas in the Last Supper both point upward. What makes this late trio of paintings distinctive is that the spiritual pointing gesture is directed personally to us, the viewer. When this late career version of the Angel of the Annunciation delivers his divine message, he is speaking and gesturing not to the Virgin Mary, but to us. Likewise, in both pictures of St. John, he is looking intimately at us, pointing the way to our own salvation. Some critics over the centuries have asserted that Leonardo marred the spiritual nature of these pieces, perhaps heretically and intentionally so, by giving them an erotic allure. A cataloguer of the French royal collection complained in 1625 that the St. John painting does not please because it does not arouse feelings of devotion. In a similar vein, Kenneth Clark wrote, "Our whole sense of propriety is outraged," adding that the depiction of St. John is almost blasphemously unlike the fiery ascetic of the Gospels. I doubt Leonardo thought he was being blasphemous or heretical, nor should we. The seductive and sensuous elements of these works enhance rather than lessen the powerful spiritual intimacy that Leonardo intended them to convey. St. John comes across as less the Baptist than the seducer, but in portraying him this way, Leonardo connected the spiritual to the sensual. By highlighting the ambiguity between spirit and flesh, Leonardo gave his own charged meaning to "the Word became flesh and dwelt among us." St. John the Baptist. From sketches in his notebook, we know that Leonardo had already begun working on his portrait of St. John the Baptist while in Milan in 1509. See figure 128 in the PDF. But as with many of his late paintings, most of which he ended up working on out of personal passion rather than to fulfill a commission, he carried it around with him and intermittently enhanced it until the end of his life. His focus was on the saint's eyes, mouth, and gesture. The close-up of him emerging from the darkness confronts us starkly. There are no distracting landscapes or lights, and only the Leonardo-esque ringlets of hair provide any ornamentation. As he gestures heavenward in a recognition of divine providence, John is also pointing toward the source of the light that radiates on him, thus fulfilling his biblical role to bear witness of the light. Leonardo's use of chiaroscuro, contrasting deep shadows with striking illumination, not only enhances the sense of mystery of the scene, it also conveys a powerful feeling of John's role as witness to the true light. John wears one of the enigmatic smiles that became a Leonardo signature, but it has a come-hither naughtiness to it that is missing in the smiles of St. Anne and the Mona Lisa. His smile beckons in ways that are sultry and seductive as well as spiritual. That gives the picture its erotic frisson, as does John's androgynous appearance. His shoulders and chest are broad, yet feminine. The model seems to be Salai, with his soft face and cascade of curls. Leonardo's oil painting technique, which involved applying multiple thin layers of translucent glazes, was by now even more painstaking and slow. He rushed no painting to a fault. In St. John the Baptist, this pace enhanced the delicacy of his sfumato. The contours are soft, the lines are blurred, and the transitions between light and dark are exceedingly subtle. There is, however, one exception. Leonardo has painted John's hand with a greater sharpness and clarity, just as he had done with the blessing hand of Christ in Salvator Mundi. The line separating John's pointed index finger from his second finger is as distinct as any line in any of Leonardo's paintings, almost like one of Michelangelo's. It is possible this is due to a misguided restoration at some point, but I suspect it was intentional on Leonardo's part, especially since he uses a similar sharp delineation for the pointing hand in what became the Bacchus version of the painting. With his theory of acuity perspective, Leonardo knew that such sharpness would make the hand appear nearer, as if in a different plane. There is a visual disjuncture. The hand is positioned at the same distance as the softly delineated arm, but because it is sharper, it seems to pop out towards us and be more in focus. St. John with the attributes of Bacchus. The other variation of this theme to emerge from Leonardo's studio, probably based on a drawing by Leonardo and partly painted by him, but also the product of others in his workshop, shows a full-length St. John sitting on a dark rock formation with a sunny landscape of a mountain and a river to his right. See figure 129. In an inventory of Salai's estate in 1525, it is referred to as a large-scale painting of St. John, and it is identified this way in an inventory of the French Royal Art Collection at Fontainebleau in 1625. But in a subsequent inventory of that collection done in 1695, the designation of St. John is crossed out and replaced by Bacchus in a landscape. From this we can surmise that, sometime in the late 1600s, the painting was altered, perhaps for reasons of religious and sexual propriety, to turn St. John into Bacchus, the Roman god of wine and revelry. There was once a beautiful red chalk preparatory drawing by Leonardo for this painting, housed in a small museum at a mountaintop religious sanctuary above the town of Varese, north of Milan. It showed St. John sitting on a rocky ledge, his left leg crossed atop his right, his body muscular but a bit fleshy, like Salai's, his eyes set deep in shadow and staring at us intensely. I have seldom seen an original Leonardo of more revealing character, Carlo Pedretti wrote in the early 1970s after making a pilgrimage to view it. Sadly, the drawing was stolen from the little museum in 1973, and it has not been publicly seen since. In this drawing, Leonardo had depicted St. John completely nude, and there is evidence that is the way he was originally rendered in the painting. But when he was converted from a Baptist to a Bacchus, a leopard-skin cloth was placed over his crotch, a wreath of ivy was put on his head, and his staff, or cross, was turned into a thyrsus. Leonardo's discomforting ambiguity between spirit and flesh was thus replaced by a less jarring depiction of a pagan god whose lustiness is not heretical. In both Leonardo's drawing and in the painting, the most striking element is the pointing gesture. Instead of pointing heavenward, as in Leonardo's starker rendition of the saint, this time he is pointing off into the darkness to his left, out of the scene of the picture. As with the Last Supper, the viewer can almost hear the words that accompany the gesture, in this case John heralding the arrival of "He who cometh after me, whose sandals I am not worthy to carry." The smile is not as seductive, and the body is more muscular and masculine than in Leonardo's other treatment of St. John. But the face is just as androgynous, and the curls just as salacious. Once again, the pointing hand as well as the left leg are more sharply delineated than is typical of Leonardo, whose signature sfumato is evident in other parts of the picture. It is unclear whether this is because the leg and hand were retouched, or were the work of a student, or because Leonardo made their lines sharper so they would feel closer to the viewer. I suspect it was the latter. Angel of the Annunciation and Angel Incarnate. Around this time, Leonardo painted another pointing figure, an angel of the Annunciation making a gesture that was similar to that in St. John the Baptist. The painting is now lost, but we know what it looked like from copies made by some of Leonardo's followers, including one by Bernardino Luini. See figure 130. There is also a charcoal drawing of it, figure 131, by a student on one of Leonardo's notebook pages, which is surrounded by Leonardo's own drawings of horses and men and geometrical figures. On the student's sketch, Leonardo used his left-handed hatches to correct the pointing arm to put it in the proper foreshortened perspective. The scene of the Annunciation, in which the angel Gabriel announces to the Virgin Mary that she will become the mother of Christ, was the subject of the first painting that Leonardo did mainly on his own during the early 1470s while working in Verrocchio's studio. See figure 11. This time, however, there is no Virgin Mary in the picture for the angel to address. Instead, he looks directly at us, and his upward-pointing gesture seems addressed to us. Like St. John, he is heralding the impending arrival of Christ the Saviour in human form, a miraculous union of spirit and flesh. The angel and St. John are depicted in the exact same pose, with the same come-hither stare, enigmatic smile, seductive cocking of the head and twisting of the neck, and glorious curls lustrously lit. Only the arm of the hand pointing to heaven has changed. St. John is turning to the left, so the upraised arm is seen going across the body. Then, as now, Leonardo's boy angels are feminine to the point of being androgynous. It is true of the angel in his early Annunciation, and also of the one in Virgin of the Rocks. In this new Annunciation, the androgyny is more pronounced than ever. The angel has budding breasts, and his face is even more girlish. There is another drawing of the angel, one that is astonishing and still controversial. Made around 1513 while Leonardo was in Rome, it shows a lewdly leering transgender version of the angel of the Annunciation, with female breasts and a large erect penis. See figure 132. Known as the angel incarnate, or angel in the flesh, it is the extreme example of Leonardo's dance around what he viewed as the ambiguous border between flesh and spirit, as well as the one between feminine and masculine. Although it is on one of Leonardo's sheets of blue-tinted paper, which he used for many of his anatomical studies and drawings of mirrors, it is unlikely that he was the primary draftsman of this angel incarnate. It is not rendered beautifully, and it is delineated and shaded clumsily, without Leonardo's distinctive left-handed hatching. It seems to have been drawn by the same student, probably Salai, who drew the notebook sketch of the angel of the Annunciation that Leonardo corrected. The smile, the gesture, the hollow eyes, the pose, and even the flawed foreshortening of the raised arm are similar. Since it was done on Leonardo's paper, it was likely done for his amusement, and perhaps with a few corrections by him, just as he had corrected the angel of the Annunciation drawing. The result looks like a catamite, eager to please, signalling a willingness for an assignation. The juxtaposition of the angel's female nippled breasts and girlish face, with its prominent erection and dangling balls, makes the drawing a cross between playful caricature and hermaphroditic pornography. The drawing echoes the theme from Leonardo's St. John drawings. It combines the angelic and the devilish, and it links spiritual aspiration with sexual arousal. At one point, someone apparently tried to erase the penis, but succeeded mainly in rubbing away the blue tint of the paper and leaving some erasure marks. The history of the drawing is a bit mysterious, perhaps because the British royal family, in whose collection it once resided, was embarrassed by it. One story is that a German scholar came to view it at the Royal Library and whisked it away under his cape. Whether or not that is true, it was rediscovered in 1990 in the private collection of an aristocratic German family. A counterpoint to the gesturing androgynous angels and saints is a poetic and sweet drawing known as the Pointing Lady, which the renowned scholar Carlo Pedretti called perhaps the most beautiful drawing by Leonardo. See figure 133. The subject has the same mysterious and enticing smile as her male counterparts, and she likewise is looking directly at us, directing our attention to a mystery unseen. But unlike Leonardo's various angels of the period, there is nothing devilish about her. The black chalk drawing is simple, but it encompasses many facets of Leonardo's life and work. His love of plays and pageants, his feel for fantasy, his mastery of enigmatic smiles, his ability to make women come alive, and the twisting movement. It is filled with the curls and spirals that Leonardo loved. There is a hint of a stream and waterfall creating eddies, and there are flowers and reeds whose curves echo those of the lady's diaphanous dress and blowing hair. Most notably, the lady is pointing. In his last decade, Leonardo is mesmerized by that gesture, the signal of tidings borne by a mysterious guide who has come to show us the way. The drawing may have been meant as an illustration for Dante's Purgatorio, showing the beautiful Matilda who guides the poet through ritual bathings in a forest, or it could have been a drawing for a costume pageant. But whatever was the original intent, it became more. It is a profoundly expressive and poetic drawing by a man entering the twilight and still searching for guidance about the eternal mysteries that his science and his art have not and cannot explain. Chapter 31. The Mona Lisa. The Culmination. And now, the Mona Lisa. Figure 134 in the PDF. The discussion of Leonardo's pièce de résistance could have come earlier in this book. He began working on it in 1503, when he returned to Florence after serving Cesare Borgia. But he had not finished it when he moved back to Milan in 1506. In fact, he carried it with him, and continued to work on it throughout his second period in Milan, and then during his 3 years in Rome. He would even take it to France on the final leg of his life journey, adding tiny strokes and light layers through 1517. It would be in his studio there when he died. So it makes sense to consider the Mona Lisa near the end of his career, exploring it as the culmination of a life spent perfecting an ability to stand at the intersection of art and nature. The poplar panel with multiple layers of light oil glazes, applied over the course of many years, exemplifies the multiple layers of Leonardo's genius. What began as a portrait of a silk merchant's young wife became a quest to portray the complexities of human emotion, made memorable through the mysteries of a hinted smile, and to connect our nature to that of our universe. The landscape of her soul and of nature's soul are intertwined. 40 years before he put his last touches on the Mona Lisa, while still working in Verrocchio's shop in Florence, a young Leonardo had painted another commissioned portrait of a woman, Ginevra de Benci, figure 14. On the surface, the two pictures have similarities. Both are of new wives of Florentine cloth merchants, portrayed against a river landscape, their bodies in a three-quarters pose. But more striking are the differences between the two paintings. They show the development of Leonardo's painterly skills and, more important, his maturation as a scientist, philosopher, and humanist. Ginevra de Benci was made by a young artist with astonishing skills of observation. The Mona Lisa is the work of a man who had used those skills to immerse himself in a lifetime of intellectual passions. The inquiries chronicled on his thousands of notebook pages, of light rays striking curved objects, dissections of human faces, geometrical volumes being transformed into new shapes, flows of turbulent water, the analogies between the earth and human bodies, had helped him fathom the subtleties of depicting motion and emotion. His insatiable curiosity, his restless leaps from one subject to another, have been harmonized in a single work, Kenneth Clark wrote of the Mona Lisa. The science, the pictorial skill, the obsession with nature, the psychological insight are all there and so perfectly balanced that at first we are hardly aware of them. The Commission. Vasari provided a vivid description of the Mona Lisa in his Life of Leonardo, first published in 1550. Facts were not Vasari's forte, and it is unlikely that he ever saw the painting, though it is conceivable that he could have if Salai had brought it back to Milan after Leonardo's death, as the confusing inventory of his estate made in 1525 possibly suggests, before it was sold to the King of France. It is more probable that Vasari had seen, at best, a copy or was writing from second-hand descriptions and allowing himself some literary license. Whatever the case, subsequent discoveries have tended to confirm much of his account, so it provides a good starting point for chronicling the masterpiece. Leonardo undertook to paint, for Francesco del Giocondo, the portrait of Mona Lisa, his wife. Whoever wished to see how nearly art could imitate nature was able to comprehend it when he saw this portrait. The eyes had that luster and watery sheen which are seen in life, and around them were rosy and pearly tints, together with the eyelashes, that cannot be represented without the greatest subtlety. The nose, with its beautiful nostrils, rosy and tender, appeared to be alive. The mouth, with its opening, and with the ends united by the red of the lips to the flesh tints of the face, seemed in truth to be not colours but flesh. In the pit of the throat, if one gazed upon it most intensely, could be seen the beating of the pulse. Vasari was referring to Lisa del Giocondo, who was born in 1479 into a minor branch of the distinguished Gherardini family, whose roots as landowners stretched from feudal times, but whose money had not survived quite so long. At 15, she married into the wealthy but not quite so prominent Giocondo family, which had made its riches in the silk trade. Her father had to cede one of their farms as a dowry, since they had little cash. But the marriage between frayed landed gentry and rising merchant class turned out to be beneficial to all concerned. Her new husband, Francesco del Giocondo, had lost his first wife 8 months earlier and had a 2-year-old son to raise. Having become the purveyor of silks to the Medici, he was increasingly prosperous, with clients throughout Europe, and he bought a few women Moors from North Africa to serve as his household slaves. From all indications, he was in love with Lisa, which was not usually a factor in the arrangements of such marriages. He helped support her family, and by 1503 she had borne him 2 sons. Until then, they had been living at his parents' house, but with a growing family and financial prospects, he bought a home of their own, and around that time commissioned Leonardo to paint a portrait of his wife, who was turning 24. Why did Leonardo accept the assignment? He was, at the time, fending off the incessant pleadings of the far wealthier and more prominent art patron Isabella d'Este, and he was so engrossed in his scientific explorations that he was known to pick up a brush only reluctantly. Perhaps one reason Leonardo accepted was out of family friendship. His father had long served as a notary for Francesco del Giocondo and had represented him in legal disputes several times. Their families shared a close connection to the Church of Santissima Annunziata. Leonardo had moved into the church's cloistered complex with his entourage 3 years earlier when he returned to Florence from Milan. His father was the notary for the church, and Francesco del Giocondo worshipped there, lent it money, and would eventually endow a family chapel. Given his nature as a sharp and sometimes contentious merchant, Giocondo occasionally got into disputes with the church, and it fell to Piero da Vinci to work them out. One of them, in 1497, involved a bill from Giocondo that the friars of Santissima Annunziata disputed. Piero drew up a settlement in the Giocondo silk workshop. So, the aging Piero, then 76, likely had his hand in helping to arrange for his famous son to accept the commission. In addition to doing a favour for a family friend and client, Piero was probably also looking after his son. Although Leonardo was now widely celebrated as an artist and engineer, he had begun to withdraw regularly from his bank account the savings he had brought with him from Milan. But I suspect the main reason that Leonardo decided to paint Lisa del Giocondo is that he wanted to paint her. Because she was somewhat obscure, not a famed noble or even the mistress of one, he could portray her as he wished. There was no need to cater to or take directions from a powerful patron. Most important, she was beautiful and enticing, and she had an alluring smile. But is it really Lisa? The assertion by Vasari and others, including the 16th-century Florentine writer Raffaello Borghini, that the Mona Lisa is a portrait of Lisa del Giocondo, seems straightforward. Vasari knew Francesco and Lisa, who were still alive when he made numerous visits to Florence between 1527 and 1536, and he became friends with their children, who likely were the source for some of his information. When the first edition of his book was printed in 1550, the children were still alive, and Vasari lived diagonally across from the church complex of Santissima Annunziata. If he was incorrect about Lisa being the subject of the painting, there were a lot of her family members and friends who could have corrected him for his second edition in 1568. Yet even though he made a lot of other corrections, the Mona Lisa story remained the same. But this being Leonardo, there have been some mysteries and disputes. Questions arose even before Leonardo finished the painting. In 1517, he was visited at his studio in France by Antonio de Beatis, secretary to Cardinal Luigi of Aragon, who recorded in his diary that he saw three paintings: St. John the Baptist, the Virgin and Child with St. Anne, and a portrait of a certain Florentine lady. So far, so good. De Beatis apparently was told this by Leonardo, which would comport with the portraits not being of some rich marchesa or notable mistress whom De Beatis might know, but of a person such as Lisa del Giocondo, who was not famous enough to mention by name. There follows, however, a confusing sentence. The painting, De Beatis reported, was done from life at the instigation, in Stantia, of the late Giuliano de' Medici. This is baffling. When Leonardo started the painting, Giuliano had not yet moved to Rome or become Leonardo's patron. In 1503, he had been exiled by the Republican leaders of Florence and was living in Urbino and Venice. If Giuliano instigated the portrait, might it have been of one of his mistresses, as some have suggested? But none of his known mistresses was a Florentine lady, and the ones he had were famous enough that De Beatis would have recognized them if any were the model for the painting. There is, however, a plausible and delightful possibility that Giuliano was somehow involved in urging Leonardo to paint or keep working on a portrait of Lisa del Giocondo. Giuliano and Lisa were born the same year, 1479, and knew each other through their interrelated families in the small world of the Florentine elite. Among other connections, Lisa's stepmother was Giuliano's cousin. Lisa and Giuliano were both 15 when he was forced to leave Florence, and a few months later, she married the older widower Francesco. Perhaps, as in a Shakespeare play, they were star-crossed lovers. Giuliano may have been Lisa's pining teenage lover, or, as Bernardo Bembo was to Ginevra de Benci, a wistfully platonic one. Perhaps when Leonardo passed through Venice in 1500, Giuliano asked him to report back when he got to Florence on how the beautiful Lisa was faring and what she now looked like. He may even have expressed the desire for a portrait of her. Or when Leonardo arrived in Rome with the painting unfinished, his new patron Giuliano may have recognized its potential universal beauty and urged him to complete it. These explanations need not replace the narrative that Francesco del Giocondo commissioned the painting. Instead, they could supplement it, perhaps add a reason Leonardo accepted the assignment, and even help explain why he never actually delivered the painting to Francesco. Another wrinkle in the narrative is that the name Mona Lisa, a contraction of Madonna, Madame Lisa, which was widely adopted based on Vasari's account, is not the only name used for the painting. It is also called La Gioconda, in French, La Joconde. That is how it, or a copy of it, was listed in the settlement of Salai's estate in 1525, which seems to strengthen the case that the Mona Lisa and La Gioconda are one and the same. It would be a pun on her name, which would appeal to Leonardo. The word means jocund or jocular. But some have argued that there might be two different paintings, citing the fact that Lomazzo, writing in the 1580s, mentioned the portrait of La Gioconda and Mona Lisa, as if they were separate works. Various theorists have scurried down rabbit holes trying to figure out who the jocund lady might be if she is not the Mona Lisa. It's more likely, however, either that Lomazzo was mistaken or that an early transcription of his text substituted "and" for "or" in his sentence. What should put an end to any mystery or confusion is the evidence discovered in 2005, mentioned earlier in my discussion of the St. Anne chronology, of the notes scribbled by Agostino Vespucci in 1503 in the margin of an edition of Cicero, which mentions the head of Lisa del Giocondo, as one of the paintings Leonardo was working on at the time. Sometimes, even with Leonardo, what seems like a mystery isn't. Instead, a straightforward explanation suffices. I am confident that is true in this case. The Mona Lisa is Mona Lisa. It is Lisa del Giocondo. That said, the painting became more than a portrait of a silk merchant's wife, and certainly more than a mere commission. After a few years, and perhaps from the outset, Leonardo was painting it as a universal work for himself and for eternity, rather than for Francesco del Giocondo. He never delivered the painting, and judging from his bank records, never collected any money for it. Instead, he kept it with him in Florence, Milan, Rome, and France, until he died 16 years after he began. Over that period, he added thin layer after layer of little glazed strokes as he perfected it, retouched it, and imbued it with new depths of understanding about humans and nature. Some new insight, new appreciation, new inspiration would strike him, and the brush would alight gently on the poplar panel yet again. As it was with Leonardo, who became more profoundly layered with each step of his journey, so it was with the Mona Lisa. The painting. The mysterious allure of the Mona Lisa begins with Leonardo's preparation of its wood panel. On a thin-grained plank cut from the center of a trunk of poplar, larger than usual for a household portrait, he applied a thick primer coat of lead white rather than a more typical mix of gesso, chalk, and white pigment. That undercoat he knew would be better at reflecting back the light that made it through his fine layers of translucent glazes, and thereby enhance the impression of depth, luminosity, and volume. As a result, light penetrates the layers, and some of it reaches the white undercoat to be reflected back through the layers. Our eyes see an interplay between light rays that bounce from the colors on the surface and those that dance back from the depths. This creates shifting and elusive subtleties of modeling. The contours of her cheeks and smile are created by soft transitions of tone that seem veiled by the glaze layers, and they vary as the light in the room and the angle of our gaze changes. The painting comes alive. Like the 15th century Netherlandish painters such as Jan van Eyck, Leonardo used glazes that had a very small proportion of pigment mixed into the oil. For the shadows on Lisa's face, he pioneered the use of an iron and manganese mix to create a pigment that was burnt umber in color and absorbed oil well. He applied it with brush strokes so delicate that they are imperceptible, brushing on over time up to 30 fine layers. The thickness of a brown glaze placed over the pink base of the Mona Lisa's cheek grades smoothly from just 2 to 5 micrometers to around 30 micrometers in the deepest shadow, according to an X-ray fluorescence spectroscopy study published in 2010. That analysis showed that the strokes were applied in an intentionally irregular way that serves to make the grain of the skin look more lifelike. Leonardo shows Lisa sitting on a loggia, the base of its columns barely visible at the edges, with her hands folded in the foreground, resting on the arm of her chair. Her body, and especially her hands, feel unusually close to us, while the jagged mountain landscape recedes into a faraway and misty distance. An analysis of the underpainting shows that he initially drew her left hand grasping the chair arm as if she were about to rise, but then thought better of it. Nevertheless, she still appears to be in motion. We have caught her in the act of turning, as if we had just walked onto the loggia and captured her attention. Her torso twists slightly as her head rotates to look and smile directly at us. Throughout his career, Leonardo had immersed himself in the study of light, shade, and optics. In a passage in his notebooks, he wrote an analysis that comports closely to the way he let light strike Lisa's face. "When you want to make a portrait, do it in dull weather or as evening falls. Note in the streets, as evening falls, the faces of the men and women, and when the weather is dull, what softness and delicacy you may perceive in them." In the Mona Lisa, he made the light shine from on high and slightly from the left. To do this, he had to resort to a little sleight of hand, but he did it so subtly that it takes some scrutiny to notice. Judging from the columns, the loggia on which she is sitting is covered, therefore the light should be coming from the landscape behind her. Instead, it shines on her from the front. Perhaps we are meant to think that the loggia is open on its side, but even that would not explain the full effect. It's an artificial arrangement employed by Leonardo to allow him to use his mastery of shading to create the contours and modeling he needs. His understanding of optics and how light strikes curved surfaces is so brilliant, so convincing, that his trick in the Mona Lisa is not conspicuous. There is another small anomaly about the way light strikes Lisa's face. In his optics writings, Leonardo was studying how long it takes the pupils of an eye to become smaller when exposed to more light. In The Musician, the eyes are dilated differently in a way that gives the painting a sense of movement and accords with Leonardo's use of bright light in that painting. In The Mona Lisa, the pupil of her right eye is slightly larger, but that eye is, and was before her turn, the one more directly facing the source of light, which comes from her right, and thus that pupil should be smaller. Was this, like the lack of refractions in the orb of Salvator Mundi, a lapse or some clever trick? Was Leonardo observant enough to notice a case of anisocoria in which one eye is more dilated than the other, which occurs in 20% of humans? Or was it that he knew that pleasure also causes eyes to widen, and was indicating by showing one of her eyes dilating faster than the other that Lisa was pleased to see us? Then again, maybe this is being too obsessive about a tiny, perhaps irrelevant observation. Call it the Leonardo effect. His skill of observation was so acute that even an obscure anomaly in his paintings, such as an uneven dilation of pupils, causes us to wrestle, perhaps too much, with what he might have noticed and thought. If so, it is a good thing. By being around him, viewers are stimulated to observe the little details of nature, like the cause of a dilated pupil, and to regain our sense of wonder about them. Inspired by his desire to notice every detail, we try to do the same. Also a bit puzzling is the issue of Lisa's eyebrows, or lack thereof. In Vasari's fulsome description, he makes a point of lavishing praise on them. The eyebrows, because he has shown the manner in which the hairs spring from the flesh, growing thickly in one place and lightly in another, and curving according to the pores of the skin, could not be more natural. That seems to be another example of Vasari's effusiveness and of Leonardo's brilliant combination of art, observation, and anatomy. Until we notice that Mona Lisa has no eyebrows. Indeed, a description of the painting from 1625 notes that this lady, in other respects beautiful, is almost without eyebrows. This has fueled some of the far-fetched theories that the painting now in the Louvre is a different work than the one Vasari saw. One explanation is that Vasari never saw the painting and embellished parts of his account, as he was wont to do. But his description is so precise that this seems improbable. A more plausible explanation is based on what seems to be two faint and blurry oblong patches where the eyebrows should have been, which suggests that they were painted as Vasari described, each hair meticulous, but Leonardo took so long to do them that he painted them over a layer of oil that had completely dried. This would mean that the first time the painting was cleaned, they could have been wiped away. This explanation was supported in 2007 by high-resolution scans made by the French art technician Pascal Cotte. Using light filters, he found tiny indications of eyebrows that originally existed. Although Lisa is sparsely adorned, without the jewels or fancy costuming that would indicate aristocratic status, her clothing is rendered with dazzling care and scientific astuteness. Ever since he was an apprentice drawing drapery studies in Verrocchio's studio, Leonardo had been observant of the folds and flows of fabric. Her dress billows gently, the light catching the vertical waves and pleats. Most noticeable are the mustard copper sleeves, rippling and shining with a silky luster that would have dazzled Verrocchio. Because he was painting a portrait that, at least in theory, was for a merchant of the finest silk, it's not surprising that he included delightful details in Lisa's layers of clothing. To appreciate the exquisite care that Leonardo took, look at an enlarged high-resolution reproduction, many of which can be found in books and online, and study the neckline of her dress. It begins with two rows of braided spirals, the pattern in nature most beloved by Leonardo, between which are interlocked golden rings that catch the light as if in three-dimensional relief. The next row is a series of knots, like those Leonardo loved to draw in his notebooks. They form the shape of crosses, each separated by two hexagonal coils. But there is one place, in the center of the neckline of the dress, where the pattern is slightly broken, and there seems to be three hexagonals in a row. Only on very close examination of high-resolution and infrared images does it become clear that Leonardo did not make a mistake. Instead, he was very subtly depicting a fold in the bodice right below her cleavage. The infrared images reveal something that is likewise amazing, but also, because we are dealing with Leonardo, not surprising. He painted the embroidered patterns on the bodice even in the places where he would later cover it by painting another layer of garment, so that we can faintly sense its presence, even where we cannot see it. Covering Lisa's hair is a gossamer veil, worn as a mark of virtue, not mourning, which is so transparent that it would be almost unnoticeable were it not for the line it makes across the top of her forehead. Look carefully at how it drapes loosely over her hair near her right ear. It is evident that Leonardo was meticulous enough to paint the background landscape first and then used almost transparent glazes to paint the veil over it. Also, look at where her hair comes out from under her veil at her right forehead. Although the veil is almost transparent, the hair underneath is painted to look a tiny bit gauzier and lighter than the hair flowing from underneath it and covering her right ear. When the unveiled hair cascades over her chest on both sides, Leonardo is back to creating the swirling curls he adored. Depicting veils came naturally to Leonardo. He had a fingertip feel for the elusive nature of reality and the uncertainties of perception. Understanding that light hits multiple points on the retina, he wrote that humans perceive reality as lacking razor-sharp edges and lines. Instead, we see everything with a sfumato-like softness of the edges. This is true not only of the misty landscape stretching out to infinity. It applies even to the outlines of Lisa's fingers that seem so close we think we can touch them. We see everything, Leonardo knew, through a veil. The portrayal of the landscape behind Lisa contains other tricks of the eye. We see it from high above, as if from a bird's eye view. The geological formations and misty mountains incorporate a mix, as did much of what Leonardo produced, of science and fantasy. The barren jaggedness evokes prehistoric eons, but it is connected to the present by a faint arched bridge, perhaps a depiction of the 13th century Ponte Buriano over the Arno River near Arezzo, spanning the river just above Lisa's left shoulder. The horizon on the right side seems higher and more distant than the one on the left, a disjuncture that gives the painting a sense of dynamism. The earth seems to twist like Lisa's torso does, and her head seems to cock slightly when you shift from focusing on the left horizon to the right horizon. The flow of the landscape into the image of Lisa is the ultimate expression of Leonardo's embrace of the analogy between the macrocosm of the world and the microcosm of the human body. The landscape shows the living and breathing and pulsing body of the earth, its veins as rivers, its roads as tendons, its rocks as bones. More than being merely the backdrop for Lisa, the earth flows into her and becomes a part of her. Follow with your eye the winding path of the river on the right as it passes under the bridge. It seems to flow into the silky scarf draped over her left shoulder. The scarf's folds are straight until they reach her breast, when they start gently twisting and twirling in a way that looks almost exactly like Leonardo's drawings of water flows. On the left side of the picture, the winding road coils as if it will connect to her heart. Her dress just below the neckline ripples and flows down her torso like a waterfall. The background and her garments have the same streaked highlights, reinforcing what has progressed from being an analogy into a union. This is the heart of Leonardo's philosophy, the replication and relationships of the patterns of nature, from the cosmic to the human. More than that, the painting conveys this unity not only across nature, but across time. The landscape shows how the earth and its offspring have been shaped and carved and replenished by flows from the distant mountains and valleys created eons ago, through the bridges and roads created during human history, to the pulsing throat and inner currents of a young Florentine mother. And thus, she is transported into an icon that is eternal. As Walter Pater wrote in his famous effusion of praise of the Mona Lisa in 1893, "Hers is the head upon which all the ends of the world are come, a perpetual life, sweeping together 10,000 experiences." The Eyes and the Smile. There are many portraits, including Leonardo's earlier La Belle Ferronnière, in which the subject's eyes appear to move as the viewer moves. It works even with a good reproduction of that painting or of the Mona Lisa. Stand in front, and the subject is staring at you. Move from side to side, and the stare still seems direct. Even though Leonardo was not the first to create the appearance that the eyes of a portrait are following you around the room, the effect is so closely associated with him that it is sometimes called the Mona Lisa effect. Dozens of experts have studied the Mona Lisa to determine the scientific reasons for this effect. One is that in the three-dimensional real world, shadows and light on a face shift as our vantage changes. But in a two-dimensional portrait, this is not the case. Consequently, we have the perception that eyes staring straight out are looking at us, even if we are not directly in front of the painting. Leonardo's mastery of shadows and lighting helps make the phenomenon more pronounced in the Mona Lisa. And finally, there is the Mona Lisa's most mystical and engaging element of all, her smile. "In this work of Leonardo," wrote Vasari, "there was a smile so pleasing that it was more divine than human." He even told a tale of how Leonardo kept the real Lisa smiling during the portrait sessions. While painting her portrait, he employed people to play and sing for her, and jesters to keep her merry, to put an end to the melancholy that painters often succeed in giving to their portraits. There is a mystery to the smile. As we stare, it flickers. What is she thinking? Our eyes move a bit and her smile seems to change. The mystery compounds. We look away and the smile lingers in our minds, as it does in the collective mind of humanity. Never in a painting have motion and emotion, the paired touchstones of Leonardo's art, been so intertwined. At the time when he was perfecting Lisa's smile, Leonardo was spending his nights in the depths of the morgue under the hospital of Santa Maria Nuova, peeling the flesh off cadavers and exposing the muscles and nerves underneath. He became fascinated about how a smile begins to form and instructed himself to analyze every possible movement of each part of the face and determine the origin of every nerve that controls each facial muscle. Tracing which of those nerves are cranial and which are spinal may not have been necessary for painting a smile, but Leonardo needed to know. The Mona Lisa's smile makes it worth revisiting the remarkable page of anatomical drawings from around 1508, discussed in Chapter 27, that shows a pair of lips in an open-mouth grimace and then drawn pursed. See Figure 111. The muscle that purses the lips is the same muscle that forms the lower lip, he discovered. Pucker your lower lip and you can see that this is true. It can pucker on its own, with or without the upper lip, but it is impossible to pucker the upper lip alone. It was a tiny discovery, but for an anatomist who was also an artist, especially one who was in the midst of painting the Mona Lisa, it was worth noting. Other movements of the lips involve different muscles, including those which bring the lips to a point, others which spread them, and others which curl them back, others which straighten them out, others which twist them transversely, and others which return them to their first position. Then he drew a row of lips with the skin layer peeled off. At the top of this page is something delightful. a simpler drawing of a gentle smile sketched lightly in black chalk. Even though the fine lines at the ends of the mouth turn down almost imperceptibly, the impression is that the lips are smiling. Here, amid the anatomy drawings, we find the makings of Mona Lisa's smile. There is other science involved in the smile. From his optics studies, Leonardo realized that light rays do not come to a single point in the eye, but instead hit the whole area of the retina. The central area of the retina, known as the fovea, is best at seeing color and small details. The area surrounding the fovea is best at picking up shadows and shadings of black and white. When we look at an object straight on, it appears sharper. When we look at it peripherally, glimpsing it out of the corner of our eye, it is a bit blurred, as if it were farther away. With this knowledge, Leonardo was able to create an uncatchable smile, one that is elusive if we are too intent on seeing it. The very fine lines at the corner of Lisa's mouth show a small downturn, just like the mouth floating atop the anatomy sheet. If you stare directly at the mouth, your retina catches these tiny details and delineations, making her appear not to be smiling. But if you move your gaze slightly away from the mouth to look at her eyes or cheeks or some other part of the painting, you will catch sight of her mouth only peripherally. It will be a bit blurrier. The tiny delineations at the corners of the mouth become indistinct, but you still will see the shadows there. These shadows and the soft sfumato at the edge of her mouth make her lips seem to turn upward into a subtle smile. The result is a smile that flickers brighter the less you search for it. Scientists recently found a technical way to describe all of this. A clear smile is much more apparent in the low spatial frequency, blurrier images, than in the high spatial frequency image, according to Harvard Medical School neuroscientist Margaret Livingstone. Thus, if you look at the painting so that your gaze falls on the background or on Mona Lisa's hands, your perception of her mouth would be dominated by low spatial frequencies, so it would appear much more cheerful than when you look directly at her mouth. A study at Sheffield Hallam University showed that Leonardo used the same technique not only on La Belle Ferronnière, but also on the recently discovered drawing La Bella Principessa. So the world's most famous smile is inherently and fundamentally elusive, and therein lies Leonardo's ultimate realization about human nature. His expertise was in depicting the outer manifestation of inner emotions. But here in the Mona Lisa, he shows something more important, that we can never fully know true emotion from outer manifestations. There is always a sfumato quality to other people's emotions, always a veil. Other versions. Even as Leonardo was perfecting the Mona Lisa, his followers and some of his students were making copies, perhaps with an occasional helping hand from the master. Some are very good, including those known as the Vernon Mona Lisa and the Isleworth Mona Lisa, prompting claims that they may have been painted wholly or mostly by Leonardo, though most academic experts are skeptical. The most beautiful copy is one in Madrid's Prado Museum, which was cleaned and restored in 2012. See figure 135. It provides a glimpse of what the original looked like before its varnish became yellowed and cracked. In addition to showing a wispy line of eyebrows, the copy displays the vibrant copper tones of Lisa's sleeves, the vividness of the blue misty landscape, the gold embroidered into her neckline, the transparency of the thin shawl over her left shoulder, and the luster highlighting her ringlets of curls. That raises the question, considered heretical by some, of whether the original Mona Lisa should be cleaned and restored, as the Louvre did its Virgin and Child with St. Anne and St. John the Baptist. Vincent Deluvin, Mona Lisa's insightful curator at the Louvre, has described the sensation he feels on the one day a year when the painting is removed from behind its glass and taken out of its frame for careful inspection. The impressions of movement are even more vibrant. He knows that just by removing most of the varnish and not touching the paint itself, the Mona Lisa which has gotten noticeably darker even in modern times, could be seen in more of its original glory. But the painting is such an icon, and so beloved in its varnished darkness, that even the lightest amount of cleaning would spark huge controversy. French governments have fallen over less. Perhaps the most interesting derivatives of the Mona Lisa made by Leonardo's followers are the semi-nude variations, often called Monna Vanna, of which there remain at least eight, one of them attributed to Salai. See figure 136. Given that there were so many of these semi-nude versions done at the time, Leonardo probably approved of them, found them amusing, and may even have provided a preparatory drawing or a now-lost original. One cartoon in the Chateau of Chantilly, which is pricked as if used as the basis for a painting, is of high quality and has some left-handed hatching, indicating that Leonardo may have contributed to it and even conceived it. For the ages. When the British needed to contact their allies in the French resistance during World War II, they used a code phrase, La Joconde garde un sourire. The Mona Lisa keeps her smile. Even though it may seem to flicker, her smile contains the immutable wisdom of the ages. Her portrait is a profound expression of our human connections, both to our inner selves and to our universe. The Mona Lisa became the most famous painting in the world, not just due to hype and happenstance, but because viewers were able to feel an emotional engagement with her. She provokes a complex series of psychological reactions, which she herself seems to exhibit as well. Most miraculously, she seems aware, conscious, both of us and of herself. That is what makes her seem alive, the most alive of any portrait ever painted. It is also what makes her unique, one of humankind's unsurpassed creations. As Vasari said, it was painted in a way to make every brave artist tremble and lose heart. Stand before the Mona Lisa, and the historical discussions about how it was commissioned fade into oblivion. As Leonardo worked on it for most of the last 16 years of his life, it became more than a portrait of an individual. It became universal, a distillation of his accumulated wisdom about the outward manifestations of our inner lives and about the connections between ourselves and our world. Like Vitruvian man standing in the square of the earth and the circle of the heavens, Lisa sitting on her balcony against the backdrop of geological eons is Leonardo's profound meditation on what it means to be human. And what about all of the scholars and critics over the years who despaired that Leonardo squandered too much time immersed in studying optics and anatomy and the patterns of the cosmos? The Mona Lisa answers them with a smile. Chapter 32. France. Final Journey. Much of Leonardo's career was consumed by his quest for patrons who would be unconditionally paternalistic, supportive, and indulgent in ways that his own father had only occasionally been. Although Piero da Vinci got his son a good apprenticeship and helped him get commissions, his behavior was variable from beginning to end. He declined to legitimate his son and excluded him from his will. His primary bequest to his son was to give him an insatiable drive for an unconditional patron. So far, all of Leonardo's benefactors had fallen short. When he was a young painter in Florence, the city was ruled by one of history's super patrons,